I have a 3-year-old named Mac who doesn't miss a beat. Mac is a bright kid and he understands when he's being left out. He keeps watching his older brothers and sisters as they have kids come over and spend the night. His older siblings are at the age where sleepovers are a big deal. Of course, Mac is too young for such a treat, but he sees his older brothers and sisters getting to have people over, and he wants to get in on the act. And so the other night, he approached me and he asked, "Daddy, can I have Jesus over to spend the night with me?" I thought that was great. He wants Jesus to come over and spend the night with him. It caused me to begin to think, though, what it would have been like for us to have spent the night with Jesus. You know, the disciples spent many a night with Jesus. They traveled with him. They camped with him. They ate with him. For 3.5 years, they spent almost every night with Jesus. What it would have been like to spend the night with Jesus. What a joy. And yet we can go to the Scriptures and we can discover just exactly what it would have been like. Tonight we're going to move at a very brisk pace through 2 exciting chapters, Matthew 14 and 15. We're going to get a feel for what it would have been like to travel with Jesus, to be a part of His crew. We're going to face tragedy and trouble with Jesus. We're going to watch Him perform miracles and provide our needs. We're going to see His compassion on the masses and His love for the Gentiles. And we're going to hear Him speak some of the most revolutionary words ever heard. In a sense, tonight, we're going to spend the night with Jesus. And so let's start reading in verse 1 of chapter 14. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch. Now, this was the son of the infamous King Herod who slaughtered the babies of Bethlehem in an attempt to kill the infant Jesus. The son was not as bloodthirsty or as powerful as his father, but in his own way, he was just as wicked. Herod the Great was a monarch. In comparison, his son Herod Antipas, this Herod, was a tetrarch. When Herod the Great died, his kingdom was divided among his 3 sons, Archelaus, Philip, and Antipas. Antipas was given the regions of Perea, which were east of the Jordan River, where John did most of his baptizing, and Galilee, which was the headquarters of Jesus. This made Herod Antipas very interested in the ministries of both John and Jesus. All 3 of Herod's sons, like their fathers, were puppet rulers, subject to the Romans. Herod Antipas, though, was a very seedy, very immoral fellow. On a visit to Rome, he fell in love with his half-brother's wife, a woman by the name of Herodias. Antipas divorced his wife, stole Herodias from Philip, his brother, and took her for himself. In addition, Herodias was actually Antipas' niece as well as his sister-in-law. This all sounds like something out of Days of Our Lives or As the World Turns. But it happened. It's true. Antipas' sins were threefold: divorce, adultery, and even incest. He had turned the nation's leadership into a soap opera. And so at the time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the report about Jesus and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him." Now, Herod was paranoid over the reports he was getting concerning Jesus because he was suffering from a guilty conscience. It's been said, a bad conscience has a good memory. God had spoken to Herod through the prophet John. Herod knew it. And yet rather than listening to the warnings, Herod decided to silence the voice of God by killing off the prophet. You see, Herod lived a life of luxury and lust, and yet a guilty conscience kept him in a state of fear and anxiety. His conscience prohibited him from enjoying his pleasures. You know, the conscience has been defined as the thing that hurts when everything else feels good. That was the case with Herod. The reports concerning Jesus and his miraculous ministry began to stir up these guilt pangs within his heart. The word of Jesus, the word concerning Jesus, the report he was receiving was causing for Herod a terrible case of heartburn. Now, here Herod shows his thoroughly pagan mentality by assuming that this is John the Baptist reincarnated. His was a paranoia founded in superstition. But to help us understand the source of Herod's horror and the reason his conscience caused him to concoct this false idea about Jesus, that he's John the Baptist alive again, Matthew flashes back to Herod's encounter with John the Baptist. And so in these next few verses, we have a flashback, a track back in time to show us why Herod's conscience is guilty. For Herod laid hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. For John had said to him, "It is not lawful for you to have her." Now, John could see the bad example that Herod was setting for the people. He was a Jewish leader with no regard for the law of God. John didn't mince words. He publicly rebuked both Herod and Herodias. He made the wicked, image-conscious queen particularly mad. She was thinking, how dare this backwoods preacher insult the king and queen in public? So she was very angry. And although he wanted to put him to death, he wanted to put John to death, he feared the multitude because they counted him as a prophet. But there was more to it than that. According to Mark chapter 6, verse 20, it's added, "But Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him gladly." In his own warped way, Herod respected the prophet John. John had purity and courage. John was a man who was unconcerned about any other opinion of him than God's opinion. For a politician who was constantly forming his positions and his policies based on the current poll, John was a breath of fresh air. And Herod looked at him and probably longed to be like him. He was so different from himself. They were the antithesis of each other. And Herod wondered what made this man tick and listened to him with eagerness and with interest. And so twofold, he was scared of the people, but he was also interested in John and what John was all about, and therefore was delaying, putting off Herodias and her desires to have John executed. But when Herod's birthday was celebrated, the daughter of Herodias danced before them. Her name was Salome. She had long legs and a tiny waist and an hourglass figure. She was young and sexy and beautiful. She had been taking belly dancing lessons. Now, the birthday bash had heated up. These stag parties for Oriental kings were common. The wine had been flowing for hours. And now the crowd was shouting for a little, quote, male entertainment. Usually these dances were performed by the hetairai, which were the prostitutes and the professional belly dancers. It was a special treat for a woman of standing. a woman of the royal court to actually perform one of these dances. Salome, though, had an ulterior motive. And so she danced before them and she pleased Herod. Therefore, he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. Now, according to Mark, he did qualify it a bit. He said, whatever you ask me, I will give you up to half my kingdom. There was a top-end limit, a cap as to how far he would go. So she, having been prompted by her mother, Herodias had put her up to this, said, give me John the Baptist's head here on a platter. It's a shame when parents put them to wicked things to accomplish selfish objectives. And the king was sorry. Nevertheless, because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him at the table, he commanded it to be given to her. And so he sent and had John beheaded in prison. Now, Mark's addendum, Herod had an out here that he refused to take. He could have said that he considered John the Baptist to be more valuable than half his kingdom. But he didn't. Perhaps he didn't even think of it. Instead, he had John executed. He had him beheaded. Herod thought more of his own image and what the other people there at the park if he reneged and went back on his promise. He thought more of the opinions of his guests than he did of John's life, the life of a man of God. John lost his head in order for Herod to save face. What a way to get ahead. You know, John kept his conscience and lost his head, whereas Herod lost his conscience to get ahead, literally. This is similar, though, to the decisions that are made every day, that are made in your workplace, that are made at your school, the decisions that go on in your neighborhood or are made in the halls of Congress. The decision of Herod is being repeated over and over again. Conscience and truth are being shoved aside so that people can climb the ladder. They can get ahead. Conscience is being muffled in order to please people and to satisfy what people think. Integrity is being sacrificed on the altar of image. You know, as Christians, we're often warned. People come to us, oh, don't make waves. You know, doc, don't rock the boat. Go along with the crowd. Just fall in line here if you really want to get ahead. Sadly, Herod's decision is repeated a million times every day. A witness for God is forfeited to please and appease the opinions of men. I suppose it's poetic justice that just a few years later, 39 AD, Herod and Herodias were accused of espionage against Rome. They were banished from Israel for the rest of their lives. They were stripped of all of their wealth and all of their importance and all of their prestige, and they were banished to the country of Spain. In the end, the man who shunned God to get ahead ended up losing everything. And his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And then his disciples came and took away the body and buried it and went and told Jesus. Now imagine the pain and the confusion and the turmoil and the disillusionment the disciples of John were experiencing. They no longer had a leader. They had lost their head. And they didn't know what to do. Let me ask you a question. What do you do when you become confused and confounded and cut off from your head? You need to do what the disciples of John did. They went and told Jesus. Rundage, that's the safe place. That's the place where your questions will be answered, where your disillusionment will be dispelled. That's the place where you can find refuge and solace and wisdom and peace. And so they went and they told Jesus. And when Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot from the cities. Now, according to Luke chapter 9, verse 10, they sailed northeast toward the town of Bethsaida. Now, on a clear day, if you were in Capernaum or Gennesaret or one of the many cities there on the northwest shore of the lake, you could easily see the disciples' boat. I'm sure by now their sail was recognizable. They knew that it was Jesus. And so as the people looked out over the lake and saw the boat sailing, they began to follow it on foot, estimating its destination. And when Jesus went out, he saw a great multitude. Already there on the seashore, a whole mass of people had gathered. And he was moved with compassion for them and healed their sick. Now, Jesus was trying to get away. All of this that had happened to John, he wanted to reflect on this. He wanted to spend time in prayer. He wanted to really seek the Lord. This was a time for him to get away and get alone with God. And now, all of a sudden, he arrives, the boat docks, and the multitudes have followed him. They've actually beaten him to this destination. Now suppose we were trying to get away, spend some time alone. Perhaps we've traveled to the mountains, we've rented a cabin for the weekend. And then as we're just settling in, we look out the window and up comes our boss and our co-workers and our neighbors and all of the people at church and the kids and everybody else are moving in a mass down the street up to the house. What would be your reaction? Frustration? Disappointment, anger, those would probably be my reactions. But this is not the word that comes to mind when we speak of Jesus. Jesus had compassion when he saw the multitude. He was moved with compassion. He wasn't worried about him being inconvenienced or his quiet time being disrupted. Compassion on them. He loved them deeply. The word translated compassion comes from the Greek word viscera, from which we get our word visceral, which means a deeply moving emotion, a guttural feeling, an instinctive reaction. The Greek word implies a wrenching, a churning of the intestines. A gut feeling is how we refer to it. The old King James used the phrase bowels of compassion. You know, Jesus didn't just see the people, you know, and acknowledge their presence. He just didn't nod at them and said, "Oh yeah, I love these guys." He felt towards them. His stomach churned when he saw them. He felt for them from the pit of his stomach. He really cared. He was moved emotionally when he saw the people. This is the degree to which Jesus loves us, and he's moved by our needs. He feels our suffering and our hurt. And when it was evening, his disciples came to him saying, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is already late." Now, we know from other details that this was probably in the springtime. In fact, John chapter 6 tells us that this was just before the Passover, which would have placed it in the spring of the year. The sun sets in Israel during the springtime around 6 o'clock p.m., and so sunset was quickly approaching. Perhaps it was 4:30 in the afternoon when the disciples came to Jesus and encouraged him to send the crowds away. They said, "Send the multitudes away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food." But Jesus said to them, "They do not need to go away. You give them something to eat." And they said to him, "Well, you have here only 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Now again, the Gospel of John fills in the details for us. One little boy had packed a lunch. He had 5 hand-sized loaves of bread and he had 2 little salted sardines. His mom had packed for him a brown bag lunch. And it was Andrew who actually found the little boy and brought he and his lunch, his brown bag, to Jesus. And Jesus said, "Bring them here to me." And then he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the grass. And he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes. And looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples. And the disciples gave to the multitudes. And as they were distributing, a miracle of multiplication took place. For somehow Jesus had altered the molecular structure of the bread and fish so that each time a piece was broken off, it added to the volume from which Jesus was serving never emptied. It refused to empty. And he just kept giving and giving and giving and stretching the 5 loaves and the 2 fishes. Guys, I want you to notice what Jesus did to the bread and the fish. And I want you to notice that this is exactly what he wants to do in your life. Here's the fourfold work that he wants to accomplish in you. He first takes the bread. He takes you. He takes you out of the world. He forgives you of your sins. He makes you his own. Second, he took and he blessed the bread. And he wants to bless you with a new life, with a new love, with a new heart. He bestows upon you God's favor and his faith. And finally, he gives you away. He uses you as he did this bread to quench, to satisfy the spiritual hunger of the people that are around you. This is all that we want. This is all that we are desiring. This is all that we like. Lord, please take me and bless me and use me. But notice, between the blessing and the giving, he does something else to the bread. He breaks it. And this is where we stop short. Lord, I want to be taken out of the world. I want to be blessed by you. I want to be used by you. Lord, I'm not sure I really want to be broken by you. But he does break us. If he's going to use us, he first has to break us. He has to humble us, cut us down to size, and remind us that without him we're little and we're puny and we're powerless. We're a brown bag lunch. To be given away, we first have to be broken. Before we're broken, we're hard, and we're insensitive, and we're proud, and we're pompous. Hey, we're indigestible. I can remember a period in my life where I tried to serve the Lord, but I hadn't yet been broken. Quite frankly, people were choking on me. I wasn't digestible. Because of my pride and my arrogance, people couldn't swallow what I was saying. Because I hadn't been broken and made into digestible pieces. And this is what Jesus must do. He has to do in order to use you. He wants to break you. There are no shortcuts. If we want to be used by God, we first have to be broken by God. And so, after feeding the multitudes, they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of fragments that remained. And now those who had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides the women and children. And so the total number of mouths is probably 10,000, maybe 15,000 people were fed. And as a result, 12 baskets of leftovers. When God supplies a need, understand the supply is always greater than the demand. There's always leftovers when God blesses. There's always more than enough when God provides. Now, I think it's interesting that there were 12 baskets of leftovers. Could be that there was one basket for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. More probably, there was one basket of leftovers for each of the 12 disciples. Because they were the ones with shaky faith. Oh Lord, how are we going to feed all these people? At the available resources. No McDonald's anywhere. A long journey to the city. How are we going to feed this mass of people? And then they look down, one little brown bag lunch. 5 loaves of bread and 2 little sardines. Lord, how are we going to do it? But you see, they hadn't figured Jesus into the equation. And this is probably your problem tonight. You're wondering, how are you going to do it? How are you going to make ends meet? It's impossible. There's no way. It just doesn't add up. Every time you sit down with your checkbook and your budget and all and try to add up the figures, it's just Andy. It's just new math included. I mean, it's just not here, man. What you're not factoring in is Jesus Christ. And He can do a miracle of multiplication in your life. No matter how little we are, if we give Him our all, there is no limit to what He can do. There's no work that He can't do through you if you make yourself available. Your impact can far exceed your wildest dreams if you give your heart and life to Jesus and just say, Lord, here I am. Break me. Take me. Use me. And likewise, no matter how little you've got, if you give your all to Jesus, there is no limit to how He can meet your need. The increase as well as the impact will be beyond your wildest dreams if you just put your trust in Jesus Christ. Now immediately, Jesus made disciples get into the boat and go before Him to the other side while He sent His multitudes, the multitudes, away. Now, notice the word made, a strong urging, he almost forcibly pushed them into the boat. He had to force them to set sail and to take off. The thrill of the miracle had so captivated them that they didn't want to leave. And yet, it's time to move on, he's saying. And you know, sometimes we get into the same thing. We hold on to the past too long. We love what God has done. We want to relish in what God has done when in reality it's time to move on. It's not what God has done, it's what He wants to do. This is what should excite us. Kathy and I were talking the other night and she said, you know, I'm really going to miss that old building. You know, here at 2nd Street, we're talking about building the new building. I'm really going to miss that building. And I said, well, I'll probably miss that building too for about 2 weeks. But you know, we can get sentimentally attached to things, to relics of the past, to buildings and places and locations and so forth. Whereas Jesus is saying to us, move on. He forces us in the boat. He says, it's time to set sail. There's new ground to cover, new territories to reach. Set sail. And when He had sent the multitudes away, He went up on a mountain by Himself to pray. And when evening had come, He was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. A northeasterly had swept down out of the mountains of Lebanon and had stirred up the lake. Now they had started out on the northern tip of the lake, and they had set sail for Gennesaret, which was south of Capernaum on the western shore of the lake. So they were supposed to be sailing from the northeastern tip to actually the northwestern tip. It was a very short voyage. But because of the storm, they went way off course. They ended up floundering around, we're told, in the very middle of the lake. They had floated about 4 miles, you know, out of their predetermined path. They were out in the center of the lake, just floundering in this storm. For some 8 hours, they oared and rowed and tried their best to make their destination, but couldn't. The wind was so fierce. Now, understand, the disciples get into this trouble because they were obedient to the Lord's command. Did you hear that? Obedience is what gets them into trouble. If they had been disobedient, they probably would have been at home in a warm house somewhere with a hot meal on the table, enjoying great fellowship, recounting the day's events and the miracles that they had seen. But because they were obedient, they encountered hardship and difficulty, strong winds and rough waters. You know, throughout the history of the church, throughout the history of Christianity, the church has been compared to this little boat of disciples. The church has always been able to see itself in this story and have envisioned itself in that little boat. The word nave is an old English word which was used to refer to the main part of the church building or the sanctuary. But the word is actually a Latin word which means ship. And it's interesting how the early church saw the main part of the sanctuary. They called it a ship, identifying probably with this story. The church is like this little boat. Obedience to God sends us into a direction that's contrary to the prevailing moods and priorities and values of the world. And inevitably, the disciples on board of the church, on board of the ship, we'll find rough seas, difficult turns. Now in the fourth watch of the night, or about 3 o'clock in the morning, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. Again, they'd struggled now in the storm for about 8 hours. They were exhausted, they were tired, they were just floundering in the midst of the water. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." You know, when we're in trouble, Jesus always comes to us. But he often comes to us in ways that we don't expect. We look around, "Lord, where are you?" And the Lord is nowhere, N-O-W-H-E-R-E. But then suddenly the Lord reveals himself. And sometimes it happens so surprisingly and so suddenly that it scares us, it startles us. Like Jesus appearing on the water in a way they would have never dreamed. And we then stop and say, the Lord is not nowhere, but now here. N-O-W-H-E-R-E. Same thing, but from a different light. We see it differently. Whereas a few seconds before the Lord was nowhere, now he's now here. He has a way of coming to us. Supernatural surprises are as much to be expected by the Christian as are the sudden storms. We should teach ourselves to look for both. When a storm arises, it's not time to panic or pressure. It's time to lift up our eyes and look for Jesus. He promises to board our boat and cheer us up. Notice, Jesus calmed the storm in the boat long before he ever calmed the storm on the sea. And friend, if you understand the purpose of the storm in your life, you'll understand that Jesus wants to work His peace in your heart long before He brings peace to your life, to your circumstances. He wants to work from the inside out. He wants to calm you in the midst of the storm. He wants to teach you that you can trust Him, and that you can rely on Him, and that you can expect to see Him when you need Him most. And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And so he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Supernatural surfing, man. Cool. Just hydroplaning across the water. Man, what a... We were at the Sea of Galilee and we tried that. We sunk. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." Now, as long as Peter's eyes were on Jesus, he was fine. But the moment he got his eyes off of the Lord and focused on the winds and the waves, man, he was all washed up. Now, he was aware of the wind all along. Even when he was looking at Jesus, he was aware of the wind. He wasn't in some kind of a trance. He was aware of what was going on around him. He was aware of his circumstances. But when his focus changed, when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was aware of the wind, but when he saw that the wind was boisterous, when he made a big deal out of the wind, then fear crept in. And repelled his faith, and he sunk. We need to learn this lesson, that walking on, that living above our circumstances, that being happy, even when life gets nappy, is a cinch when we keep our eyes on Jesus Christ. Sure, acknowledge your circumstances. Be aware, be responsible with your duties, but don't the winds and the waves. You know, don't get impressed by your circumstances and by your troubles. Don't get overwhelmed. Keep your focus on Jesus. And you'll stay on the surface of the water, man. You'll be hanging ten spiritually. Just rejoicing, elevated above the circumstances and above the troubles. Just living in the heavenlies. Rejoicing in the joy and peace that God brings. But the moment your attention shifts from your troubles, or from Jesus to your troubles, that's when you're sunk. Notice here, Peter's doing fine, and then all of a sudden, he gets boisterous and he sinks. It's almost comical, it's almost laughable, but at least Peter got out of the boat. And that's something some of us have yet to do. We all can laugh at Peter, but at least he dared to believe and trust God to keep him up and to make a difference in his life. And some of us have never taken that step of faith. We're still sitting in the safety of the boat. We're still a spectator. We still like to watch others step out in faith. But we've yet to do so for ourselves. We've never really trusted God for anything. We've never really gone out on a limb or put ourselves in a risky position. We've never stepped out in faith and depended upon Christ to keep us up. At least Peter got out of the boat. And the other thing about Peter here is when he began to sink, he knew exactly what to do. He cried out saying, "Lord, save me." Jesus did. Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Now, in extra-biblical writings, Peter is nicknamed the giant. And there are many people who believe that he was a large, strong man. But apparently, Jesus was also a very strong man. Because he reaches down with one arm and he curls Peter into the boat, the giant. Remember, Jesus was a carpenter before the days of chainsaws and power saws and, you know, electric nail guns and all. He was strong. Jesus wasn't a wimp. He was a muscular guy. He was a strong guy. He was a real man. And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Always remember, the Lord that allows the storm will eventually still the storm. He allows the storm for our growth, for the strengthening of our faith, for the development of our character. But just remember, if you're going through the storm tonight, the Lord who allows eventually stills the storm. Trust Him and be teachable. And then those who were in the boat came and worshipped Him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." And when they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret. Notice, when they had crossed over. Jesus had told them to go over to the other side, not go under to the other side. And Jesus had fulfilled His promise to them. Let's recap Jesus' attitude toward the disciples and toward this little boat in the water. He first sends them into the storm. But while they're in the midst of the storm, fighting and floundering in the storm, He is on the mountain praying for them in the midst of the storm. Then He comes to them during the storm. Finally, He brings them through the storm to the other side. This is what Christ does for His church. He sends us into the storms. He orchestrates the storm in order to build faith and character into our lives. From the mountain, He sees our trial and He prays for us. He is at the right hand of the throne of God, interceding for us. But then He comes to us in the midst of the storm and He boards our boat and He calms our fears and He gives us a reason for good cheer. And finally, He has promised that we're going over, not going under. And He delivers us through the storm and saves us from the storm. Jesus' attitude, His relationship to this little boat and the disciples is the same as His relationship between us and the church. What a wonderful story. Delve into this passage. What a meaty story. What a comforting story for us. So when they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret. And when the men of that place recognized Him, they sent out into all that surrounding region. They brought to Him all who were sick. The land of Gennesaret. During my first trip to Israel, we stayed at a kibbutz in the land of Gennesaret, a place called Naph Gennesar. It was right on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was a wonderful place to stay. And they begged Him that they might only touch the hem of His garment, and as many as touched it were made perfectly well. Now, according to Numbers chapter 15, verse 38, every Jewish male was to sew tassels onto the hem of his garment. And in the tassels, there was a blue thread. Now, the blue stood for heaven. It reminded them that their life hemmed on heaven. They were only a small thread away from heaven itself. And so when people reached out and touched the hem of Jesus' garment, in their own mind, they were touching the power of heaven. They were bringing heaven to earth, and they were being healed because of their faith. The same is true today. If you want to know the eternal, if you truly want to touch God, reach out and touch the hem of the garment of Jesus. Do it by faith. Now then the scribes and the Pharisees, who were from Jerusalem, came to Jesus saying, now these were not serious seekers. These were theological hitmen that were trying to trap Jesus and ensnare Jesus and to find fault in His teaching so they could label Him a blasphemer. And they ask Him, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. Now, the Jewish rabbis taught that in addition to the Mosaic Law, that God gave to Moses other instructions that were also very important. These instructions Moses failed to write down, but he did transmit them to the elders who then passed them on to the elders of Israel orally. The Jews believed that these traditions were the key to correctly interpreting the law. And at the end of the 2nd century AD, these traditions were recorded and codified in a work known as the Mishnah. Now, to some rabbis at the time of Jesus, the oral law, or these traditions, was just as important, if not more important, than the written law. And in the Mishnah, there are 35 pages devoted to this subject of ceremonial cleansing, or ritual cleansing, describing in detail the proper mode of washing one's hands. You see, the Jews placed a high premium on the physical, the external washing. They thought that external washing was essential and necessary for spiritual purity. Some rabbis taught that there was a demon by the name of Shibna who would come at night while you were asleep and settle on your hands and just sit on your hands. So that the next day, if you went to eat your food without washing your hands, this demon would slip in through the food and take over your body. And so it was very essential, according to the rabbis, that you wash your hands before dinner. And not just before dinner, but they required that you wash your hands between each course of the dinner. So in a 7-course meal, you'd have to wash your hands 7 times. They even had a specific procedure for washing. You would take 1.5 eggshells of water and pour it over your hands as they were pressed together uprightly, letting the water drip only to your wrists and no further. Then you'd flip your hands over, and you'd pour the water the other direction, pointing them downward, while yet another 1.5 eggshells of water was poured over them. Finally, you would rub your right fist into your left palm, then your left fist into your right palm. Actually, when we were in Israel and we visited the Wailing Wall, there was a basin and a spigot right next to the entrance to the wall where you were supposed to wash. Go through this washing of the hands before you entered into the holy place. You know, the Jews were so insistent on this outward purity that one rabbi was excommunicated for not washing his hands before he ate bread. The story is told of another rabbi who was so serious and so diligent in these ritual cleansings that while he was incarcerated by the Romans, he almost died of dehydration because he used all of his water rations to wash his hands rather than to drink. This is how zealous these fellows were. To them, washing was their way to heaven. And so it really upset them that Jesus and His disciples were not following their traditions. And so they said, you know, what is this? You don't wash your hands before you eat bread. But He answered and said to them, why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? For God commanded, saying, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, whoever says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me has been dedicated to the temple, is released from honoring his father or mother. Thus you have made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition. You see, the rabbinical traditions were so important to the Pharisees that they had placed them above the actual law. One rabbi wrote, tradition is a fence around the law. In other words, they didn't feel like you could interpret the law accurately until you first had understood the traditions. And before Jesus deals with the central issue here of washing the hands, he shows them how that rather than their traditions, rather than those traditions helping them to keep the law, they had actually hindered them from keeping the law. They had provided them excuses and loopholes around the law. They weren't fences around the law. They were holes in the fence, loopholes that gave the people excuses from keeping the law. The classic example is what Jesus mentions here. It was the law of Corban. The word Corban means gift of God. And if a child knew that his parents were in trouble and they were coming to him for financial assistance, then he would take all of his major holdings and all of his valuable possessions and he would pronounce over them the word Corban and would dedicate them to the temple. Now this meant that they could remain in his possession, but they couldn't be sold or given away because they were dedicated to the temple. Oh, what a convenient excuse for a person's selfishness. You could send poor mom and dad away and look spiritual in the process. Oh, sorry, mom. Sorry, dad. All this is dedicated to God. Just so spiritual. Sorry, I can't help you. See, the whole scam to hide the people's selfishness. They could turn down their poor parents and feel spiritual in doing it. Jesus is saying this is not building a fence around the law. This is making a farce out of the law. This may be keeping the tradition of the elders, but it's sure not honoring your father and your mother. Hypocrites. Well did Isaiah prophesy about you saying. Here he quotes Isaiah 29:13. These people draw near to me with their mouth. They say the right words and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrine the commandments of men. You know, we need to be constantly on guard against mistaking the doctrines of men for the commandments of God. But after I got saved, I went through a process of going back in my mind and in my heart and re-examining all of the traditions that I had learned to see if they were truly biblical. Whether they were biblical or just babbical. Whether they were truth or just tradition. Oftentimes what we do in the church is based on tradition rather than truth. We've forgotten why we do it. We just do it that way because it's the way we've always done it. What's traditional may not be bad, but it still may not be biblical. And when a better way comes along, rather than being wedded to the past, we need to be free in Christ and able to embrace that new way of doing things. Our goal should be to obey God, and if the traditions help us, great. But if they don't, if they hinder us, we ought to kick tradition out on its ear. Then he called the multitude and said to them, hear and understand. Not what goes into the mouth defiles a man, but what comes out of the mouth, this defiles a man. Jesus is saying that as far as God is concerned, the heart of the matter is the matter of the heart. One biblical scholar says of this passage, well nigh, this is the most revolutionary passage in the New Testament. You see, to the Jew it was. For outward cleansing and ritualistic purity was as much a part of Jewish thinking. You know, so much so that they just couldn't hear it. And for most of the people who heard this, that it's not what goes into a man's mouth that defiles him, what comes out of his heart. I mean, they had been brought up on the kosher laws, on the dietary laws. And for Jesus to say, it doesn't really matter what you eat. It's what comes out of your heart. I mean, it just sailed over most of their heads. It was so foreign to their thinking. We know it did, especially for Peter. For years later, on a rooftop in Jaffa, the Lord spoke to Peter again concerning the same issue. And he showed him a picnic blanket full of unclean animals. And he said, "Arise, Peter, kill and eat." In essence, he was repeating the message of Matthew, that outward but inward. True purity doesn't originate on your plate or have to do with your hands, but it has to do with your heart. Purity works from the inside out, not from the outside in. Then his disciples came and said to him, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying?" Jesus, do you realize you're not being politically correct? Jesus just didn't care about offending people who needed to be offended. But he answered and said, "Every plant which my heavenly Father has not planted will be uprooted. Let them alone. They are blind leaders of the blind. And if the blind leads the blind, both will fall into a ditch." This is why it's so dangerous to be trapped in tradition. If the practices and the beliefs and the lifestyle that you're living are nothing more than the inventions of man, they will one day be uprooted and thrown away along with those who embrace them. The inventions of man are on the way out. Only the conventions of God will last forever. Make sure what you're doing is biblical, not just traditional. Then Peter answered and said to him, "Explain this parable to us." This wasn't a parable. Peter didn't have a clue as to what he had said. This was a straight, direct teaching. And so Jesus said, "Are you also still without understanding? Do you not yet understand that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and is eliminated? But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man. But to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a man." True righteousness, God's righteousness, is inward, it's spiritual, it transforms my heart and it works its way out. False righteousness, self-righteousness, is outward, it's physical. It might touch, it might even train my hands, but it doesn't tame my rebellious heart. True purity originates not in what I eat, but it begins with the beat of my heart. It begins in the seat of my soul, down in the center of my being, where I trust God and believe in Him. Then Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. Now this was Gentile territory that He was moving into here. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to Him, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed." Now, this was a Canaanite woman. She was a Gentile. But she had seen Jesus in operation, and she had been in the Jewish crowds. And she had seen Jesus heal the sick and cast out demons. And so she used the formula that she heard. She had heard this expression, "Son of David." This was a messianic title. It was taken from 1 and 2 Samuel in the Davidic covenant. This was the plea that so often was spoken when people came to Jesus for healing and for help. And so in her mind, this was the formula. The formula of faith. And so she comes to Jesus with these Jewish words, with this Jewish attitude, even though she's a Gentile. And He answered her not a word. Martin Luther, in his commentary, writes, "Now he is as silent as stone." If we didn't know better, we'd think he was being rude. He was lacking compassion. But in reality, he was testing her faith. Charles Spurgeon says, "Our Lord had a very quick eye for spying faith." And here he sees in this woman, we know from later, he sees in this woman potentials. Great potentials for faith. And with great skill, Jesus draws a deeper faith out of her. He causes her to cross over some barriers and to reach down deeper and become more honest and genuine before Him. Next time the Lord is silent, when you come to Him with a request, take into consideration that He may see potential in you and He may remain silent in order to draw some things out of you. You may find Him silent because He wants you to grapple with some things and become more honest and more genuine in your approach. So often we have these formulas by which we approach Him. But He doesn't want formulas. He wants genuineness. He doesn't want words. He wants substance. And oftentimes it's His silence that coaxes a greater faith out of our hearts and out of our lives. But He answered her not a word, and His disciples came and urged Him, saying, "Send her away, for she cries out after us. She's just bugging us." Now you would think by this time she would be so discouraged that she would just sulk away. Everything was going against her. She was a Gentile. Jesus was a Jew. She was a woman. Jesus was a man. She was annoyed by the an annoyance to the disciples. She couldn't even count on them to put in a word for her. You'd think she just would have walked away depressed. But she persisted. And you see, this was what Jesus was wanting to draw out of her. He wanted to see her true heart. He wanted to see her. He wanted her to come out from behind her mask and really be herself. And express herself and be herself before Him. And to be honest with Him. He wanted her to be persistent. And He answered and said, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." And then she came and she worshipped Him saying, "Lord, help me." What a different approach this time. Not, "O Son of David." Not these Jewish words and these Jewish formulas. But no, she's just being honest now. She's dropping the mask. She's saying, "Oh Lord, help me." Being honest. You remember in Luke chapter 11, Jesus told the parable of the man who went to his neighbor for bread. It was late at night. He had a guest. He needed to borrow some bread. And the man refused to get up. But he kept beating on the door and beating on the door. And Jesus says it was because of his persistence that his neighbor finally agreed to go to the cupboard and loan him some bread. And then Jesus tells us, "Ask and it shall be given you. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and the door shall be opened to you. For everyone who asks," literally, keeps on asking, "you shall receive. And he who keeps on seeking, you shall find. And he who keeps on knocking, the door will be opened." I believe that God remains silent until my desperation exceeds my dignity. And until I drop my mask and my phony facade and my religious words and the formulas that I've learned, and I just humbly and honestly and openly cry out, "Lord, help me." And when your desperation exceeds your dignity, Jesus has you where He wants you. But He answered and said to her, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." Now this is the first softening of His attitude toward her. This word "little dogs" in the Greek didn't refer to the mongrels that roamed the streets, but it referred to the household pets, the puppy dogs. And here he calls the Jews normally refer to the Gentiles as mongrels, but Jesus here calls her a puppy dog. And he says, it's just not right to take the food that goes to the children and just throw them out to the little dogs. But Jesus knew and she knew that the little puppy dogs were allowed to feed around the crumbs that fell from the table. Or what the children didn't eat, the puppy dogs got. She was following his rationale. Her eyes lit up. And she said, true, Lord, yet even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Here she's saying, Lord, I know I'm a Gentile. She's being honest. She's being herself. It's the real person who's talking now. I know I'm a Gentile. I know that the gospel is first to the Jew and then to the Greek. Lord, I know that I'm only deserving of the leftovers, but Lord, it's the leftovers that I need. And I trust you. Will you give me just the crumbs from your table? Then Jesus answered and said to her, O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed from that very hour. And Jesus departed from there, skirted the Sea of Galilee, and went up on the mountain and sat down there. Now Mark tells us he has now moved into the Decapolis. Decapolis means 10 cities. There were 10 cities on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee that were Hellenistic cities. They were cities that were preoccupied with Roman religion and Greek culture. They were crowded with idols to false gods. They had bathhouses. They had all of the Roman pleasures and perks. And they were places of opulence and luxury. The Decapolis. Jesus is now again moving into Gentile territory. And then great multitudes came to him, having with them those who were lame, blind, mute, maimed, and many others. And they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. And so the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking, the maimed made whole, the lame walking, and the blind seeing. And they glorified the God of Israel. Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the multitude. Because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. What a healing service. I mean, they had just been healing and healing and healing. And people were being forgiven and they were being healed of their diseases. And demons were being cast out. And the food now had all been eaten up. There were no longer any resources. The people were hungry now. Been 3 days this meeting had been going on. And I do not want to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way home. Then his disciples said to him, where could we get enough bread in the wilderness to feed such a great multitude? Now, this passage is a very controversial passage because there are some people who say that this is not another miracle of multiplication, but this is simply the retelling of the feeding of the 5,000. Now, I disagree with that for several reasons. Number one is there are a lot of dissimilarities between the two stories. For one, they sit on the grass here. They sat on the grass when they fed the 5,000. Here they sit on the ground. The grass is now dried up. It's not springtime. It's summertime. The feeding of the 5,000 took place in Bethsaida. This takes place in the Decapolis. One took place in springtime. The other took place in the summer. 5,000 were fed earlier. Here, 4,000 are fed. 5 loaves and 2 fishes were used to feed the 5,000. Here, 7 loaves and just the fish are used to feed the 4,000. 12 baskets were left over in the earlier story. Here, 7 baskets are left over. And then if you'll look in Matthew chapter 16, verse 9 and 10, if you have any doubts left, notice the words of Jesus, do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up, nor the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up? So even Jesus himself knew that there were, and testifies to the fact that there were two different events, the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. Now, the reason it's controversial, and the reason there are people who would like to say that the two events are the same, is actually to cover up for the disciples. Because the rationale is, how can anybody be this stupid to ask this question? After just seeing 5,000 people fed with 5 loaves and 2 fishes, how could they come back just weeks later and say, where could we get enough bread in the wilderness to feed all these people? I'm not so sure they are questioning, could Jesus do it, as much as they are questioning, would Jesus do it? I don't think they're doubting whether he can, but I do think they're doubting whether he will. It was one thing in their minds for him to do this for the Galileans, they were Jews, but for him to do this in the Decapolis. These were Gentiles, and those Jews who were there were Jews who had sold out to the Gentiles. They were compromisers. They were blasphemers. Many of them were idolaters. They had forsaken Judaism and had embraced the Roman ways and the Greek culture. And I think the disciples were wondering in the back of their minds, hey, surely he won't work this kind of a miracle for these people. He could do it in Galilee, but not here in the Decapolis. But Jesus said to them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7 and a few little fish. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves and the fish and gave thanks. Again broke them and gave them to his disciples. And the disciples gave to the multitude. And so they all ate and were filled. And they took up 7 large baskets full of the fragments that were left. And now those who ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. You know, guys, there are times in our lives where we don't doubt whether Jesus can. We know he can. He's worked in our lives before. He's done miracles in the past. But we really wonder if he will. Because perhaps we are now living in the Decapolis. Perhaps we've made some compromises. Perhaps we're not as faithful as we once were. Perhaps we're not spending time with Jesus like we once did. Perhaps we're not reading as much and praying as much as we did back in Galilee when Jesus did this great work. And we really wonder whether he will do it again. It's not that he can. That's not what we question. It's whether he will. And there are times when our faith is tested. And it's amazing how subtly the idea that God blesses us because we deserve it creeps in. And start thinking, oh, well, we deserved it back in Galilee. We don't deserve it now. Wait a minute. You never deserved it. It's by faith. It's just trusting him. It's just by being in the presence of Jesus and calling on his name. And even if you're in the Decapolis tonight, even if you've strayed away and you've gotten far from Jesus, even if you're in this place tonight, Jesus can still do the work that he did before if you'll trust him. And if you'll open your heart to him, and if like this Greek woman, this Syrian woman, the Canaanite woman, and if you'll just drop your mask and stop with all the religious words and just say, Lord, I've failed you and I'm sorry, but I need your help. And Lord, I'm asking because of your grace and mercy, will you bless me and will you help me? Will you feed me tonight? He will. He promises to do so. He fed the 4,000 and he'll feed you. And he sent away the multitude, got into the boat, came to the region of Magdala.